Settlement and other things, the court only has one matter on the soil submission docket today. It is the City of San Benito and others versus Rio Grande Valley Gas Company and others from Hidalgo County. The court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioners may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We are recording these arguments and you may purchase a tape for a nominal fee from the clerk. Justice Enoch is not sitting in this matter. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioners.
May it please the court that as a prosecutor, we present argument for petitioners. Petitioners deserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please this honorable court, Adam Poncio appearing on behalf of the petitioner. As this court indicated in Bernal, federal decisions and authorities interpreting current federal class action requirements are persuasive authority in Texas. The question in this case being whether the petitioners in this case can bring by appeal questions regarding the settlement and class action where they have not intervened in the underlying lawsuit. In this particular case, we have a recent United States Supreme Court case interpreting federal class action rules, which has held that non-named class members, like petitioners in this case, who have objected in a timely manner to approval of a settlement.
Well, let me ask you this.
Yes,
Devlin, there was the party appeared at the fairness hearing.
Yes, Your Honor.
And did object, and we had a record of the substance of those objections. It seems that the objection that the city's filed here solely as to the opt-out and had nothing to do with the merits or the substance of the proposed settlement. Is that correct?
No, Your Honor. The actual objection to the settlement in this case went to the merits of the settlement as well.
What can you point to me what it said about the substance? I haven't looked at the document, but what objection was made to the terms of the settlement before the hearing?
Looking at the objections to the settlement, Your Honor, cities object, and yet the amount is inadequate to compensate the cities for the damages. They also object that the attorney's fees sought was excessive in light of the settlement.
But they did not appear at the hearing and express why it was inadequate or put on any evidence or quantify it in any other way.
Your Honor, the federal interpretations of the objections requirement, particularly under Newberg and the cases cited therein, are that all that is required is that the objections be on file. There's no necessity to appear.
But I guess what I'm saying is the trial court never had an opportunity to really address the substance of your objections since you didn't appear at the hearing, correct?
Well, Your Honor, the requirements for that are that we file the objections. I believe that the objections were specifically set out enough that the trial court could have addressed these objections.
Well, perhaps for preservation purposes, but for purposes of determining whether, if we reach the merits, the trial court abused its discretion, we don't really have a record to flesh that out, do we?
Not with regard to the actual objections to the settlement, Your Honor, but the question that comes before this court with regard to petitioners is, if you haven't intervened, can you raise that on appeal, and therefore, could it have been addressed?
So you're not asking us to reach the merits today. You want us to say the Court of Appeals was wrong in saying that you were not properly in that court and send it back to the Court of Appeals to address the merits?
Yes, Your Honor. I think what we are asking the court to do is, one, to hold that we could appeal the class action, thereby allowing us to appeal the court's rejection of our opt-outs. We believe that
you really want to go all the way back to the trial court.
No, not necessarily, Your Honor.
What do you want? What do you think this record entitles you to get by way of ruling from this court?
We think that this record allows us to be held that, one, we can appeal, and two, that we properly opted out and should not even been considered as part of the class action. Therefore, the merits of the class action themselves would not actually be reached because we weren't a part of the settlement. We weren't a part of the class action. We never should have been because we properly opted out of the class action. That's what we're asking this court to decide here today.
The only decision that the Court of Appeals made in the appeal had to do with standing, and they just dismissed the lack of standing. And as I read your petition of review, you didn't, at least at that point, challenge the Court of Appeals holding in that regard. Why can you now argue standing for this court?
Well, we feel, Your Honor, that all of our points of error go to the issue of standing, and that could they even be addressed first with us being here before this court. Could this court address any of those issues without there being standing? We feel, therefore, that they could be considered included in each of those points that we raised.
But what's confusing about it to me is that the sole, you know, there obviously there are two things going on, the appeal and the mandamus.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the sole issue reached in the appeal was standing. And that was all that they talked about. And so I would have expected that the petition would have addressed that first and maybe get to the other arguments that you make, but at least make that the central thrust of your petition before this court.
We felt, Your Honor, that all of these points necessarily included the question of standing because the court would never address any of those issues without the issue of standing being addressed first. Moreover, Your Honor, at that time, the case law was that in order to appeal any of those issues, it had to be an intervention. Now we have the United States Supreme Court's case saying that under Devlin, we did not need to intervene. Our problem was we were in a catch-22 situation. The catch-22 situation was, if we intervene, is there any waiver of our contention that we had properly opted out? If we appeared at the fairness hearing, was there any waiver of our contention that we had properly opted out and should not be even considered a part of the settlement? That's what our whole argument is, Your Honor. While we failed to artfully address it, we believe that it is an issue that is necessarily included in each of these points addressed in our petition and more specifically addressed in our brief on the merits.
Let's talk about the Devlin case a minute. That was a settlement class.
Yes, sir.
Really, the parties had no opportunity to get into the case until it was over. In this case, you had at least a year between early 2000 and early 2001, between the time that the trial court ruled your opt-outs were not timely, and the time the final judgment was passed.
Should we look at some type of latches or waiver that should be imposed upon you because you did not give the trial court an opportunity to rethink its ruling during that 1 year period?
No, Your Honor, I believe that from all intents and purposes, looking at the court's disregard of all the opt-outs filed by the parties, including by city attorneys, by Mr. Ramon Garcia on behalf of GMTCI, that it was obvious that the court's intent was to allow this settlement to go forward, allow this case to go forward. Subsequently, Your Honor, as part of our objection to the settlement, we asked for reconsideration. The court still overruled that. It was clear that it had considered that as part of its final judgment. Latches was never raised by the respondents in this particular case. And I don't think that we necessarily had to seek any other relief in the interim. Once the appeal was final, once the judgment was final, we could go forward with our appeal saying, Your Honor, we had opted out in the first place. We should never have been considered part of this. We're now asking the Court of Appeals for relief, and then subsequently this honorable court.
because that was within the scope of the attorney's responsibilities to the city having been hired, and also because the cities had already hired somebody else, essentially.
That's right, Your Honor.
Work.
The TMTCI contract was very specific. The TMTCI contract provided that TMTCI, after having consulted with city, shall have the power and right to employ legal counsel of its choice to represent city in enforcing any claim through necessary litigation.
Would that mean in any type of class action if somebody already had an attorney that was looking into the matter the class action was related to that they could not properly be considered a part of the class action?
I think that attorney should have the right to decide whether to opt in or opt out. In this particular case, the attorneys, after consulting with the city, made the determination that they should opt out because the settlement was way below the actual value of the case. For example, in this particular case, the city of San Benito would have received approximately $18,000 out of the settlement. We believe that the value of the judgment or the value of the case was in excess of $1 million. The only people making money in this case were the attorneys, which is improper under any standard, looking at the Lloyd opinion and the other opinions.
It's not something we're supposed to be. It's not something you want us to look at.
I think, Your Honor, that the first issues to look at are whether we opted out. If the court holds that we properly opted out, then I don't believe we have standing to address the actual merits of the settlement. If they believe that we should be considered part of the class, then I think that the merits of the settlement should be looked at, or at least remanded back to the 13th Court of Appeals for them to make a consideration of whether it was a fair and adequate settlement, which we believe it was not, on behalf of any of the cities.
I have just one minor kind of housekeeping question. Are you as a petitioner representing Donna San Juan, Benito Salamos, and Pedroza Bahia Primera Bar today, or do you concede that they accepted the settlement or not?
I concede that they accepted the settlement, Your Honor, but what happened in this particular case is, knowing that we represented these cities, they were approached by class counsel, asked to sign these documents in violation of the attorney-client relationship, but we believe that that's a matter for another day.
So, essentially, when we look at our job, when we craft some judgment in this case, it would not include the group.
I don't believe it would, Your Honor. I believe that's a separate matter. With that, Your Honor, I believe that we've primarily addressed all of the issues. As I indicated, I wanted to bring to light the Devlin case. We've addressed everything else we believe adequately in our brief regarding those issues and the questions that we brought to the court. With that, I'll reserve any further time for rebuttal, unless there are other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from response.
Thank you,
Court.
Elizabeth Coggins, Ms. Hawkins will open the first amendment.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Elizabeth Hawkins, and I'm representing the respondents, the cities of Mercedes and Weslaco, who in the underlying lawsuit were the class representatives. Subject to obviously what's on the court's agenda and the questions that they are asking, I would like to address the following 4 points. Ms. Timms will be addressing the fairness of the settlement as well as the procedural aspect of the case for the court. What I've heard the court ask, and I would like to address the issue of with regards to the authority of Mr. Ramon Garcia to opt out, which is one of the areas that I will be talking about, which is the opt-out effect by an attorney who we believe does not have authority to properly opt out. In addition, I would like to talk to the court about the delegation of authority, the retrospective effect of the ratification that the petitioners have brought out, and then finally, I believe the distinctions of the Devlin case, which I would like to address with the court. First, with regards to the delegation of authority that the petitioners have brought to this court, we believe that it is that the petitioners misframed for this court the issue of inaction by a municipality in being involved in a class action. In fact, in the state of Texas, there have been many public entities that have been involved in class actions. But more particularly, what we believe this court needs to look at is
There's no challenge this court, this stage, to the idea that this case could probably be set up as a class.
We did not challenge it, but there has been briefing, sir, that with respect to the inaction of the municipalities, this goes
to... I'm talking about the whole challenge that nobody should be in a class, that these are individual contracts and they can be litigated individually. That's not any longer... That's been in the Court of Appeals.
Yes, sir.
We didn't have jurisdiction on it, or at least nobody tried to weave their way through jurisdiction, and it's not any longer preserved for us to consider at this level. Is that right?
Yes, sir. Your Honor, then let me move on.
So we'll just assume that 90 cities or 82 or whatever it was can be a class.
And we're in agreement with that. Okay. That's always been our position, Your Honor. Then let me address the opt-out with respect to the notice that has been provided. I would like to address with the court that the fact that the petitioner made mention that the notice may not have been adequate and or ample time to provide a notice to these cities to opt out. Obviously, this was never an argument made by the respective petitioner city up to January 31st, 1999.
Why should they have to make much argument? Why shouldn't they just be easily get out of the class?
Well,
and typically in class actions, class members don't have lawyers, and they're not sophisticated, and they just get a notice in the mail. Why shouldn't it be as easy as pie to get out of the class?
Well, Justice, the Rule 42 sets up a procedural mechanism whereby once the court determines that through the elements of Rule 42, the due process of the class members, that group have been set. So the court comes in and determines what is the method whereby you can opt out. Again, it is to create a cohesive, organized...
cram them all in against their will? Shouldn't they have a reasonable time and an easy way to get out of the class? Isn't that the whole point of opt-out? We want to make it easy for people to opt out if they don't want to be part of the class.
And Justice, we do argue that they did have ample time.
38 days.
During the summer.
Yes, sir.
And you also say that the attorney can't make the decision. This has to go before the city governing body in full compliance with open meetings to make this type of legal decision.
Well, Justice, what the Open Meetings Act deals with, that if a city is going to make a decision, is going to decide to opt out, that it has to...
Why can't the lawyer do that?
Well,
why isn't that a litigation strategy?
I want to be very clear, Justice, that Ramon Garcia is not a city attorney who would have had a general authority, possibly under a charter. Mr. Garcia wasn't even named in the general franchise contract that petitioners bring forth to this court. In fact, Mr. Garcia, in fact, these six or seven contracts that would be in front of this court, because there are six or seven petitioners in front of this court, these contracts were all entered into prior to this piece of litigation being certified. And in actual...
He was their lawyer or not?
No, sir.
He was not their lawyer.
No, we make the argument, sir, and I believe he was not their lawyer at the time this piece of litigation was certified and required the cities to have a formal meeting to opt out.
Was there a motion to show authority that was filed in the case?
There was a notice set in this case. There was a motion to show authority approximately in November of 1999. A hearing was held in the trial court in relationship to the opt-outs. And at that time, it was brought forth to the court, the trial court, that these agreements were entered into, at least the ones that are currently in front of the court, were entered into prior to the June 24th, 1996. And in fact, at that hearing, The petitioner's counsel admits that these agreements were not intended to actually specifically opt out of this piece of litigation or any other class action. In fact, that was a general franchise fee collection contract that would have been entered into prior to the June 24th certification, and it was designed so that an audit could be done of franchise fee agreements. Then, yes, it did provide an option that if they could not negotiate or could not collect on the franchise agreement, then they would be authorized to hire a lawyer to help them. But never at a point in time was that agreement set up or notice given to the public or a hearing held on hiring Ramon Garcia to opt out for those particular petition fees. And so we have here a situation where a lawyer was dead on his own, opted out. Then, almost 3.5 years later, when there was a hearing in November of 1999 by the trial court to determine the viable members of the class, ratification ordinances were done. We argue, we submit to the court, that you can't ratify a prior illegal act. Mr. Garcia was never given authority to opt out for these cities.
City wants out, and a lawyer who claims to represent the city opts them out, and then the city later says, that's right, that's what we wanted to do, and we wanted him to be our lawyer to do that, and you said that can't be done.
The ratification would be effective after, which in 99 was when these cities ratified, the court determined under its abuse of discretion that that wasn't a timely opt-out. That, in fact, because these entities are required to, as a governing body, to take action, if they take action, they need to do it in an open meeting. Thereby, Justice, what they needed
today
to
do is, do you have to have an open meeting every time you authorize counsel to take action in case you file a motion for summary judgment?
With respect to any action that the governing body would take to further its business, and that would be...
How do you decide, as a case moves on down the road, what a city sitting there, what do they have to authorize their counsel to do ahead of time in open meetings act? In what place retain counsel?
The Open Meetings Act does have a definition of deliberation and the purpose of the open meeting. And Justice Wood, what the Open Meeting Act says that if you are going to further the business of the city, and I would argue that unless the charter, because the city, a home rule city would be ruled by its charter as well as state law, its charter, and there are cities, like the city of Houston as an example, it has allowed its attorney, the city attorney, not another attorney, but the city attorney, the right and the honor.
I ask you a specific question about you hire counsel to represent the city, and in the piece of litigation, how does the city determine when it has to have an open meeting and specifically authorize its attorney to take specific actions in the lawsuit?
Well, Justice, at the point in time that the city would hire that particular lawyer, it would be assumed that they, depending on how the open meetings provision was set up and how the contract was set up to hire that lawyer, it would determine whether he takes other action or whether he comes back. The contracts we're looking at never even hired a lawyer. They hired a consultant firm to look at franchise litigation. While there would have been the ability for a lawyer to look at and help the consultant with negotiating franchise.
So you're saying the city serves as a lawsuit. They've got 38 days to do something. They can't even hire defense counsel without an open meeting to file an answer on it.
Well, I would submit to this court that the city would first look at its charter to determine whether it had the authority by its own city attorney to do that. Because there are charge provisions that would. If not, I do think that most cities do meet at least once a week.
What under law requires them to have an open meeting, hire a lawyer to respond to their law?
Chapter 551 of the
the government code requires that any time a city transacts business, it has to have an open meeting. It then could have created, it could have had a contract with Ramon Garcia at that period of time to opt out and take all action necessary to handle this piece of litigation. None of these cities do that. Or Justice, excuse me.
Any other questions?
Yes, let me ask you. I know you say Ms. Timms done. Deal with the fairness, but let me ask you about the settlement, be sure I understand it. The agreement says it's for a total of $4 million, approximately $2.1 million is to go to class counsel, is that correct? $1.7 million plus $333,000 in expenses.
That's correct.
And it says that's going to be paid whether there are any participants in the participating cities or not. Is that right? Irrespective of the number of non-participating cities.
That was the term, yes, sir.
Everybody wants out of this, you're still going to get $2.1 million.
The terms of the settlement agreement, Justice, was that the lawyers who had been working 4.5 years on this piece of contentious litigation would receive that amount of money.
Yeah, and who's going to pay that?
Well, Southern Union obviously paid that, and then their arrangement would have been if the cities would have agreed, whatever cities agreed to the settlement would pass that through. Those were normal, the actual franchise fee collection amounts, as well as the attorney fees and costs would have been passed through.
In other words, the consumers are going to pay for this. The people that are buying the gas. Mr. Jones is writing a check to Southern Union or Rio Grande. He's going to pay these attorneys.
Each city had an ability to determine whether they wanted to accept the settlement and pass it through.
Yeah, I understand, but I was just asking, is the consumer going to pay the money that's going to go to the lawyer for the attorney fees in this case?
I believe, in a particular city that would choose to accept the settlement.
And what's he get for that?
Well, what he would have gotten was the ability that the local natural gas distribution company would be paying the city the appropriate franchise fee.
Well, but they're just getting it from the consumer.
Well, these entities, and I will have to defer to Ms. Timms on some of this, Justice, but the franchise fees have, as these entities have been able to do it through their tariffs, have always been passed through to the consumers.
I understand that, but now what are they getting for? Now their franchise fees are being raised, and $2 million of it is going to a lawyer, and what have they got for? Any better gas or any better service or anything?
Justice, I'm not able to answer your question.
Well, you're class counsel. Why can't you answer?
I wasn't involved in all the terms of the actual settlement, Justice. But yes, I do believe that the consumer received the benefits of actually having the natural gas distribution company pay the terms of its, under the terms of its franchise agreement with each individual city that accepted the settlement.
It looks to me like if I were Mr. Jones and I were buying gas in the city, one of these cities, city of San Benito, I wouldn't care how high, I wouldn't want a high street charge or franchise fee because it's just coming out of my pocket. It doesn't do me any good. Might as well be paying taxes. Is that wrong?
No, Justice, but I believe that each individual's governing body of each city made a determination of whether they would accept, and that was one of the terms of the settlement agreement, was that each individual city could decide whether it would accept the terms of the settlement and if then pass it on to the residents of that particular city.
It strikes me that the gas company and the city and a lawyer have all gotten together and said, we ought to take some of these folks' money away from them and split it up among ourselves. They don't have a lawyer. They're not represented in the class. They don't have any say in this, and it's their money.
Justice,
is that a wrong view of the settlement?
Justice, I don't believe that that is a complete view of the picture. The view of the picture is that from the beginning of 1995, when this lawsuit was filed, to the time it was settled in 2001, there was 5 years of contentious litigation with regards to the particular issue. The defendants fighting feverishly that they believed they did not owe that money, that clearly under the terms of the franchise agreement, they did owe. Now, I don't believe that at any point in time, at least through the history of my participation in this, that there we all sat down and decided that, well, let's just all get together and settle this agreement and then pass it on to the consumer. In fact, class counsel rejected at the fairness hearing about the passage.
Where is that? I couldn't find that in the fairness hearing. And there's not a slight to it in the agreement. Maybe you could supply that.
I will.
Because I didn't. I know you said that in your brief.
I will be right. If the court would allow me to submit, I'll be able to find it.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Okay. I want to address procedural issues and then fairness questions very quickly. My major problem on the procedural issues is I just do not see how the court reaches the major issues in this case. Because they are required to complain in their petition for review about the dismissal. That's the entryway, the doorway through which they get into the rest of the issues. And they've never complained about the dismissal in their petition for review in the issues.
And you don't think it's a, whatever the rule says, a fairly...
I really don't. I mean, you almost have to argue. What their argument truly is... It's a logical argument that doesn't hold together. It is because we were required to complain about it, therefore we did. And practical experience just teaches you that doesn't hold together. If you read the petition for review, everything, the issues, all of the discussion, everything, you would not even begin to guess that there was a dismissal, that there was a problem with the dismissal, that there were standing issues, that there was anything wrong with, you know, anything having to do with immigration, or any of those things were out there. If you just gave it to a reasonable reader, they would not see any of those issues.
Durbin says this isn't really about standing. This is just really about agree that you don't have a choice but to agree that. But this is the U.S. Supreme Court says. But is that the same issue under the statement? But it's not about standing, it's about it.
I believe that that's true. But I will say this. That issue is just not in their petition for review anyway. It's just not fair. They tacked it into their brief. This court's rules clearly say that you can't add new issues to your brief. And that's what they tried to do. I told them in April that issue needed to be in their brief, in their petition. They did nothing. We told them again in July. We suggested, you know, that we mentioned that they had failed to amend their petition. They didn't do anything about it then. And here we still stand. That is the overriding issue. Judge O'Neill, I just wanted to note real quick, even if you give them sort of everything that's in the Court of Appeals opinion, and say, we'll count that as sort of in the record. You know that they filed objections. You know the date they filed objections. You have no idea what the objections were. The objections are not in the record before this court. They just attached it to their brief, but it was not in the record.
Could the record be supplemented?
Well, they have to. The problem is the record coming out of the Court of Appeals. They did not make sure that those things were in the record going out to the Court of Appeals.
Well, the rules still allow supplementation. Do I speak to which court or what level?
Well, how can you say that the Court of Appeals erred? Because at some point, even if you give it in there, you're going to have to say that they abused their discretion. And how can you say that if that was not before the court?
And they never made motions to supplement, and that court went to these same problems were pointed out there. On the fairness, let me just say that I think that some of your thinking, Justice Hecht, is right. I mean, really what Southern Union is, it almost stands in the shoes of the tax assessor collector. And franchise taxes are really an indirect tax between the city and its citizens. And you've got to trust the city to act correctly on behalf of its citizens. And the citizens, if they don't like what the city is doing, need to go to the polls of the next election and elect these city leaders.